we live in a society that makes it hard for us to keep an elevated level of empathy going. When we're feeling overwhelmed or stressed or anxious, we cannot feel empathy. The gap between us knowing what our human nature is and then doing something is that we really, really do not invest enough time or resources on the inner work that's required. The times are urgent. Let's slow down.
Hello and welcome to The Empathizer, the podcast for more mutual understanding in our society. My name is Sebastian Kremser and I listen to my guests to understand what moves them. Today I listen to Anita. She is tired of constant doom and gloom. She believes that people have a choice in which direction things go. She talks about what has made us successful as human beings and encourages us to change the way we look at the situation with empathy. We talk about what it takes for inner development so that we can tackle the world's problems, what role AI can play in this, and how important it is to experience connection so that we can be human feelings and human beings. We can choose empathy and mutual connection at any moment, and now have fun listening. Welcome today to the podcast Empathizer, Anita.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And as usual, I will start with my question. What is it? What is important to you? What is moving you, which you would like to be heard with?
I love that opening question. It's so expansive. What I'm leaning into these days quite a bit is the idea of uplift, the idea that I don't know if you're paying attention in Europe, but in the United States right now, there's a federal election. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic National Party had its convention, and the word joy and hope keeps repeating. And I think there's a zeitgeist at the moment where there are two narratives playing out, which one is there's darkness, doom and gloom. We shouldn't like each other or trust each other. And another narrative, which is we can do better. We are better. Let's do better. And so the idea of uplift, the idea that humanity as a whole is on the ascension, the idea that we can raise our collective consciousness, and there are tools for that, is very inspiring to me because I think it's very tough to take action when you feel pessimistic and you feel what's the point. But I think if there are opportunities to grow and develop and heal and collaborate and all of these ways that humanity has thrived anyways, the idea that humanity has a choice to make about how we move forward is an important conversation to have. And I'm finding more and more people are interested in tuning into that conversation. They're tired of the doom and gloom.
Interesting. So what I hear is that the topic which is moving you and important for you is uplifting, and it comes from this doom thinking and possibility thinking and potential thinking, and you are interested in how can we increase our human consciousness to do better, right? And you have the experience that you meet more and more people who are thinking about that too.
I do. And I think the wisdom of traditions have been saying this forever, right? What humanity and what our life's purpose is about. And then we live in a society that complicates that and tells us different narratives and different messages. I like thinking a lot about biomimicry and how the natural world seems to self-organize in a way that allows it to flourish. And there's a lot of characteristics of a flourishing ecosystem, right? It's in balance. There's diversity. There's different sizes. So there's just a nature knows what to do. And I think we also know what to do. I think we all feel really sick about where the world is at right now. And now it's time to step up.
Oh, yeah. Sounds to me that you talk about this, the nature, and actually we know how to be connected, right?
We do.
And what is it, what's the question for you you have with this topic, you know? Because you...
Well, okay, so if I think back to the scientists that study our evolution,
mm-hmm.
and Jamil Zaki has written about this. He's a psychologist at Stanford, written quite extensively about empathy. He says that about 40 or 50,000 years ago, Homo sapiens were not the only large brain species wandering the earth. Mm-hmm. There were other friends, our peer group. But Homo sapiens are the ones that survived as a species. Why mm-hmm. is that, right? So the evolutionary scientists that look mm-hmm. at that have studied what happened in our bodies that has changed. One thing that happened to us as humans is that we lost most of our facial hair so that we could read each other's facial expressions easier. And what I find super interesting is that the whites of our eyes grew very big. Relative mm-hmm. to every other mammal on the planet, we have the biggest whites mm-hmm. of our eyes. And again, that is so that we can actually communicate using our eyes without language. And so I think the scientists say one of the reasons why we flourished is that we were able to communicate and empathize with one another as we worked together collaboratively against mm-hmm. whatever the threats were.
Mm-hmm.
And so empathy and collaboration has been part of our success story.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to continue to be part of our success story.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. And if we go even further back the lineage, we share DNA in common with chimpanzees and bonobos. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming across the research that as humans, we share more DNA in common with each of those species than they share with each other, which I think is kind of a little bit mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that we swim in about humanity and human nature is the chimp story, that we're violent by nature, prone to violence. Mm-hmm. History is littered with examples. Today, we have examples on the planet. But there's a very wonderful primatologist by the name of Franz De Waal, who died recently, mm-hmm. who studied bonobo culture for 40 years. And you see story after story after story after story that bonobos are loving and kind and tender by nature. And so I think the invitation to us all at this moment is, how can we lean into our bonobo nature? How can we turn mm-hmm. up the volume of empathy in our lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting question. And at the same time, when I'm listening to you, I wonder, why do we have this kind of doom narrative?
Yeah.
When I listen to you on the scientific basic explanations, why we are this, why is this, has this doom perspective such a big impact in our observations or what we receive? And, you know, I'm wondering about this.
And, you know, as you're asking the question, I'm noticing your cadence. And it's such an invitation to me to take a nice, big, deep breath and slow mm. things down. So anybody who's listening might want to do the same.
Mm.
Give me a chance to take a nice, long, deep breath, because I do have an answer for you. I think one of our human tendencies towards doom and gloom thinking is because we have an amygdala in the back mm-hmm. of our brain. And it's the first part of our brain that grows in the womb. It's the first part of our brain that developed in us as a species. And then other parts of the brain, including now our neocortex, has kind of kicked in. But we are still react when our amygdala fires. And the reason we have the amygdala is to survive.
Mm.
Amygdala gets all triggered when there's any form of threat. It mm. used to be the saber-toothed tiger. It mm. used to be the enemy clan. Now it's taxes, now it's social media, clickbait. You know, we're triggered by all mm-hmm. sorts of things. But people are exploiting the fact that we still have that natural tendency to guard against threat.
Mm.
And so politicians will exploit that through their stories of pointing fingers at those people are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think, and the media, you know, it's a money-making organization. So when it bleeds, it leads. So there's not enough stories circulating in our culture about all the bonobo aspects of our lives. But we know it, right? You and I know it. We're happy. I mean, here we are communicating across the ocean via Zoom. Yep. Happy to be in conversation with you. Yep. Happy that there might be people listening. What's that about?
Yep.
That's about connection.
I see. Yeah. And it reminds me to this knowing doing gap, you know, we know all this stuff, but we behave in a way my question to you is, how do you feel about this? Because I'm thinking about, we know all about this and we behave, or we can observe a lot behavior, which is disconnecting the people. Anyway, because we both observe this, we working on this kind of how we can connect, right? By sitting here and to having the connection here. And there we see the gift of technology, right? And social media. Though without this, we couldn't do this right now. So there's this positive part of it. Anyway, how do you feel about that? This triggering of amygdala and then the alert and the alert behavior of people, and yeah.
So I'll answer that question by way of a story first, and then mm-hmm. I'll unpack the story. So I wrote a book. It was a mm-hmm. labor of love. It took over a decade to write, and it came out last year, and I went on a book tour. And the first leg of my book tour was on the East Coast. So Boston, DC, New York, Toronto. I'd been away from my family for 16 days, and they were really long days. Sometimes I did two or three events in a day, lugging the books around and then staying at people's houses so I could save a little bit of money, and then doing the dishes with the kids. So, you know, then working till 2 or 3 in the morning on the emails for the next round of events. So I was exhausted, like properly exhausted, bone dead exhausted, coming home on a train from Toronto to Montreal. And it's a 5-hour train ride. And 20 minutes before arriving home, the train came to a complete stop mm-hmm. on the tracks. And the engine went off. And your reaction was the same as everyone else's on the train. Like, oh. And it took an hour before somebody who works for the company, the train company, who came on and was obviously going cart to cart to cart to cart to make an announcement that sadly somebody had taken their life on the track and there'd been a mm-hmm. suicide. And that it would take a little while before the police could come and do their investigation, and then the train would be able to carry on. And the moment she made that announcement, me and everybody on the cart, you could feel it. It was visceral that everybody was changing their perspective on their own situation. And I called that a moment of collective empathy. Like, we all felt for that poor soul. Mm-hmm. And then it took 4 hours before the train started moving again. So by 9 p.m., we were supposed to get home at 5, and by 9 p.m., we finally arrived at the train station, and everybody was, forget about that poor soul, thinking like, get me off this train, I got stuff to do, it's late, I'm tired, I'm hungry. And I continue to spend time reflecting on what happened, that we all had this rise of empathy. How come we couldn't stay with that empathy? How come we lost it? It evaporated in those few hours. And the conclusion I've come to is that, one, we live in a society that makes it hard for us to keep an elevated level of empathy going. And that's harder to solve. But the second thing I realized is that my own reserves of empathy were low because I was just exhausted.
Yeah.
And those who study our biochemistry and our physiology say that when we're feeling overwhelmed or stressed or anxious, we cannot feel empathy. To our brain, it's not possible to be in both states. So that put me on a track to say, oh, you know, I've spent 15 years studying empathy, so I know it from a theoretical perspective. And yes, I've introduced empathic ways of being in my life. I've taken courses and I have practices. But what have I done internally, in my internal landscape as a human being, to have the capacity for more empathy on a regular basis? And so, to answer your question, the gap between us knowing what our human nature is and then doing something is that we really, really do not invest enough time or resources on the inner work that's required.
Mm.
The meditation, the mindfulness, slowing down. You know, one of the most beautiful quotes I came across last year in October when I was at a conference is from Bayo Akomolafe.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "The times are urgent. Let's slow down."
Mm-hmm.
I find that a very powerful statement. Yeah. And it's tough for us to do. You know, I'm raised in a family, immigrants to Canada, work, work, work. That's how you get your, how you succeed in life. And the idea of rest as a practice is, I think it's in the German ethos as well, right? You work hard, you show up on time. Yeah.
Yeah. Connected to that, today I was asked, what would I do if I would do things not because of money? And I said, I would do the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it's my, somehow the principle I follow. Yeah, I was thinking, what would I do if I don't want to earn or to need the money, you know? And then I'm looking that I do the thing I would do even when I don't get the money for it. So, and if I get money for it, fine. It helps me, right?
Yeah.
But I see the point, yeah.
That's why I think universal basic income could be quite interesting. Imagine if people had their basic needs met.
Hmm.
What would they do with their time otherwise?
Yeah. Yeah. So the experience you had in the train with the suicide person and the huge common emerge of empathy in the coach and the and then it quickly shifted after you have arrived at the station. So this was an experience you made. So, oh, wow, what's going on here, right? How could this happen? And this brought you to the thing how we know all the stuff which is needed to be connected and by this finding better solutions for our urgent problems. And you realize that, okay, there's a huge amount of practice needed, or maybe some kind of rituals and habits we need to integrate it, right? That it becomes a natural, that it becomes back somehow a natural part of us in our behavior, right?
Yes.
And what I was thinking when I was listening to you, wow, that's a big issue actually, because that means we have, from my perspective, we have to think about our structures we have, which blocks us to practice this, what you mentioned.
Yeah.
Because our awareness and focus is driven or pushed to something else, like being effective, earning much of money, right?
Yeah. And I suffer from it. I mean, even though I know it, I mean, I can't tell you how many days have passed where it's 4 o'clock and I don't think I've had a glass of water.
Mm. You mean for in the evening, right?
Yeah. Or in the afternoon. I'm like, I've gone to the washroom because I haven't had anything to drink. No wonder I have a headache. No wonder my body feels like this.
Yeah.
I'm stressed. Yeah.
Because you are focused on
work. Getting work done. I mean, the list goes
that is what you mean with suffering, right? Physical suffering.
Yeah.
Hmm. So it seems to me when you realize that, something has changed in your life. Could it be?
Yes. I can't say that I'm on the other side of the issue. But I'm a work in progress in a way that is actually really intentional. So my husband and I, for example, I'm exploring modalities that allow me to be more present and to elevate my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never a drug user, but I've been reading a lot about psychedelics and what they open up. There's a renaissance in the therapeutic circles about how helpful psilocybin can be for anxiety, depression, all that. And I recently heard about a woman who offers sort of like a shaman service in your home where you do a lower dosage of psilocybin. And she, you know, there's a five hours you spend together. So the first hour is talking about what the intentions are. Then there's the experience. And then there's the debrief and integration.
Mm.
And when we hired her and we tried this. And initially our conversation was, she was describing how our brains, which I know about, you know, it's plastic, brain plasticity, the neural pathways of our brain, you know, are not predetermined. We can move them, we can shift them. She said, the reason why psilocybin is so effective to treat some illness or some mental health issues is that it actually breaks apart some synaptic connections and creates new ones. So you think differently. And she says, you may have an experience while you're having the plant medicine in your body, or you may in the next 24 or 48 hours feel a difference. And I don't know for sure if it's the experience I had with mushrooms or not, but I think it is. The next day, my husband and I were going about our business. My daughter was at summer camp, and I spoke to him sharply for no reason. I spoke to him sharply, and I heard myself speak sharply to him. And it was bothering me. So 4 or 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, I'm still thinking, like, why did I talk to him like that? That was so unnecessary. He does not deserve to be talked to like that. I went to see him to apologize. And he accepted my apology, and that was nice. And we didn't make more of it. But for me, it wasn't finished. 10 minutes later, I was still thinking about it. And I started asking myself with a sense of curiosity, not a sense of shame, but a sense of genuine curiosity. Why did I speak to him like that? So I went over to him and I said, can we talk about this? Can we unpack this together? Why do you think I talked to you like that? Because I can't figure it out. And we ended up having a conversation about the family I was raised in and the way that we communicated as a family and the functioning and dysfunctioning of our family. And I realized that we speak to each other harshly with a lot of criticism and a lot of passive aggression. And then I realized the adult in me is just repeating some of the patterns that I grew up with. So my neural pathways are already formed in a particular way of behaving, but now I'm an adult and I can choose to do things differently. And I send the child in me compassion that she wasn't raised in a more generous, sweet, empathic, loving environment, but I can let that go now. And so it felt to me like an opening. I'm not going to say that I'll never speak harshly to him again and that I'm cured of that. But it was for me a moment of like, oh, I approached this issue in such a different way. So I want to do Vipassana. I was training for a marathon. Like, I'm trying all these different ways to see how can I behave in my life in a way where I do a little bit more slowing down, reflecting, healing.
So you reached a level of consciousness where you started to, actually develop yourself with consciousness, right?
Yes. Yes. Without shame. And I think that's a big part of it. We're hard on ourselves.
Yeah, without shame and without guilt and even without a have to do, right? Just from genius curiosity.
Curiosity,
right? And so I guess from this, I know it's a step-by-step process, but this is somehow the vista point where you get, can you remember the situation, right? And where the change was observable for you, right? And I think I get the idea of it, why this topic from today, which is important for you, where it comes from, because of this insights you had, right?
These very real lived experiences that I didn't have as a fleeting thought, like had it and then parked it away or ignored it. Like really, I'm really lifting these ideas up as a way of reflecting carefully on my life, because, you know, we both have in common the inner development goals, something that we're attracted to as a framework. The idea that to solve the problems that the world has cannot just be by action. It needs to come from an ethos and a way of being in the world. That we're in harmony with ourselves and harmony with each other. And then it's just so much easier to move to a different paradigm. So I really am very, very, very seriously trying to at least experiment with those kinds of modalities. A hopefully to evolve, hopefully to embody more of that.
I know. I think I got you. What you mean with uplifting? Uplifting myself and uplifting my consciousness and awareness about how things work, right? And how it's interconnected and how important it is. It is, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you back. Let's make this more of a conversation.
You
Have
can,
you had similar experiences? Have you, how does all this land for you personally?
In general, I can say yes. And now I'm thinking about to bring up a similar spiritual experience you made with the mushrooms and the guided process with the woman. I was in Portugal. I visited the community. It's called Tamara. It's it's somehow an alternative eco-village community. And they have built a stone circle, right? With over 100 stones in it. And then they did an exercise with us. We should pick a piece of paper where a number and name of a stone was written on. And then we should go to the stone and connect to the stone. I was doing that and I said, it's a stone. Nothing happens. The stone doesn't speak to me, blah, blah, you know. What is this? I said. So 2 days later, there was a guy in our group of the visitors. He seems to me like a yogi, you know. A strange guy. He could meditate just immediately and we could see all the white in his eyes when he just started doing this in a moment for a moment, right? And once he said to me, "Oh, let's go for a walk," and he walked with me again to this place where the stone circle are. And when we came closer to the stones, I started to sense something. So, oh, what's going on here? Something is different. And actually, afterwards, I realized it was full moon, right? Okay, I'm not such spiritual, but strange. And then I did a deep experience about, wow, what's going on? I just walked to the stone. I was 2 days before. And then I got a message from the stone or from the universe, let's say. Yeah? It was very strange. And then I was saying in my mind, I can't believe what I'm experiencing here. I need a material manifestation.
Yeah? You need to feel it, touch it.
I need something physical to believe what's going on here. And then he said to me from the back, I was saying this in my mind, right? And he said, okay, I guess it's enough, he said, right? And then I turned from this back to from the stone, and just in front of me on the ground, pressed into the ground, there was a meditation tool which Buddhists used to meditate. It was not it was something made by humans. It was there, thus like someone has lost it, right? And I said, a minute before I was saying to me, I need something physical to believe it, and I turned and then it was there. And so this was very strange. A strange experience. And then I noticed, okay, here's something bigger going on. I don't understand now or yet, but this was, it has happened without using any psychedelic stuff, you know. It was just, I don't know, you could say I was emotional before any reason, I don't know, but it was from nowhere, without intention, this has happened, right?
Yeah.
That was some very spiritual experience from me to that. And then there was something, the feeling of, okay, there's something more we usually not see or sense. So, and then I just started with all my other tool experience I made, you know, this typical awareness, mindfulness experience. We know the kind of experience and methods which became common in management too, you know. But I know from this experience, oh, there's something deeper or holistic. And we have not, maybe we have, when we are born, maybe we have it somehow by nature to be able to sense it.
Yeah.
But in our socialization, I guess we lose it somewhere. And in my work, when I work with leaders, leadership coaching, and with teams, I know when I can activate this kind of, let's say, energy or whatever, the room and the space in between is different and something different is the outcome. So that's why.
I love that story. And thank you so much for sharing. I'm glad that happened for you. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with a woman who's based in Turkey. She's in Istanbul, mm-hmm. and she has a PhD in sense making, like how mm-hmm. human beings make sense of the mm-hmm. world. So it's very kind of theoretical and abstract, but they're discovering more and more about how the brain works. But in her case, she was saying that we make sense of the world through stories and that, you know, you and I will have this podcast. And then if we finish the podcast and then we tell anybody else about this podcast, or even if we reflect on it ourselves, the way we will reflect on it is through the story of what happened. And our story, your story and my story will be different, and people listening will have a different story. So we work in stories. It's a fascinating conversation. And we eventually landed on her belief that AI has great potential to serve mankind. It has lots of possible perils, but the reason she's hopeful is that AI and quantum computing will be able to basically outsource our thinking. Because right now we do the thinking, but the computers can eventually do the thinking, and then we can become human feelings, human beings.
I see.
And we will be able to do some energy work between us, relating work that's going to heal the world. Anyways, it was a fascinating conversation, and it just made me think of it as you were describing the story.
I'm checking what my resonance to this theory or idea is. You know, what I was thinking, in general, I think every technology development can contribute to our human being and help us to unfold our potential as human beings. What I was thinking is, like, from the problem thinking perspective, when we use it from a perspective where we think about how can it contribute to the world, to the society, to the human beings. And instead of that, not usually, but I can observe too, is people see AI, they see social media, whatever, new technologies, and then they're thinking, how can I use it to make money? And I was thinking about, how important this thinking about how we use it is, in case of this neuron wiring system we have in our brain, So if I just start to think about, how can we make money off it? Then we go in this direction, or we think, how can it contribute to our well-being?
Yes, and that is the big issue, I think, is that what work gets rewarded and what are the incentives? I mean, the idea, it's not so bad in Europe, but in North America, I think it's quite dreadful that we make decisions where the profit motive and incentive is so present, and it's the individualism of it, as opposed to the collective well-being. So it comes down to values, really. What do we value, what structures do we put, or systems do we put in place to honor those values?
Oh, wow. I said, oh, wow, because I had the thought in mind, I understand maybe why people are not interested in connection. It seems to, I don't believe that they are not interested, but I believe everyone, when he experiences connection, wants connection. Anyway, when you get profit and you have a lot of profit and then you have money as a universal strategy to fulfill all your needs, you could start to think about, I don't need the connection because I have the universal strategy to get what I want, right? And the sadness in this is maybe that someone who gets rich because of profit never experiences feeling of being connected.
Possible.
It was just a thought in my mind. And they are not aware about it, that this is an alternative possibility instead of profit.
There's an evening in my class. I teach a social entrepreneurship class to undergrads at McGill University. And there's about 40 students in the class. And one night every semester, we do what's called public narratives. And this is a tool that was developed by Marshall Gans at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And The public narrative is a way of storytelling where you tell the story of self, the story of us, and the story of now. So a little bit about you, a little bit about what we have in common, and like the story of now is like, what's the urgent thing you're calling on others to do? Mm-hmm. But it's a way of inspiring people to take action. So I use it in my social entrepreneurship class as a leadership development skill, and they have 3 minutes to share a story, to do the public narrative. And the class is 3 hours long, but that night we go 4 hours because it takes that much time to get through all 40 students. And when I tell the students going into the semester that that's what's going to happen, one night we're going to spend 4 hours together and we're going to hear 40 stories in a row, people's eyes are like glazed over, like, oh my God, a 4-hour class, or oh my God. But I've done it, I don't know, at least a dozen times, probably 15 or 20 times by now. It is the turnover class. It is the before and after class. Students sit there in awe of one another because they show up with courage and vulnerability. I mean, of course, they're primed to do that. Obviously, I tell them, don't bring up dirty laundry. This is not a moment where we're trying to get you to confess your deep, dark secrets. Mm-hmm. But everybody shows up for one another. And there's so much community building and a sense of belonging and a sense of mutual empathy for one another, because everybody sees the common threads. Your sister had bulimia. Oh my gosh, my cousin suffered from something, or your brother, you know, like all these issues that happen in the world. And so you're right. I think if more people knew how good it feels to be in communion with one another, we wouldn't need as much stuff. But the narrative, the drumbeat is not that. The drumbeat is you're flawed by this to make you better.
And then we're at the point where we need to
differentiate.
Yes, between outer and inner, right? Because it's the outer story that you have to make profit, and profit means money. And my inner dialogue is, yes, I want to make profit too, but my profit is social connection.
Wow, that's.
And when I go a little bit more radical to this side, I would say, and then I do not need money anymore.
Right.
Because of a connection, a conversation, things we really need will somehow evolve.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a mindset of abundance. Yeah. We live in a mindset of scarcity for the most part.
Yeah.
It's nice. I've never met you before. I don't even know much about you. I didn't do a long bit of research before coming onto this podcast because I've had a crazy, crazy week and day. And look at this profound conversation that we're having.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But yeah, which we can create by listening to each other and the intention of seeing each other with what's moving us without judgment, or say it otherwise, by being non-judgmental.
Yeah.
And just by what is alive. And this is what you explained me in the 4 hours class. You know, when I'm listening to you, it sounds to me that the energy comes from the point that everyone can show up and be what he or she or it is.
We don't have a lot of spaces for that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Just to be ourselves, just to be appreciated for who we really are.
Exactly. And being accepted and valued, because then you can start to see what is the individual, unique potential and talent.
Yeah.
You don't need the frames to compare who fits in it or not, you know.
No. Yeah, the differences are celebrated. And the sameness that's universal is also celebrated.
Yeah. And we need both.
We do.
Yeah. For me, there comes up a new word. It was power, because the frame you only need when your attention is power, having power over, you know, then you need the differentiation and the frame to say you fit in, you fit not in, and you have to behave this way, then you are invited to be part, or you are okay, blah, blah. And usually it's, from my perspective, the power over strategy. And actually, this is a threat, you know, which, yeah.
Yeah, which is why, so I know you were saying earlier that you've had conversations about what does empathy mean 20 times, so there's no point in having that conversation again. But what I would add to this conversation that I think might be valuable is that when I was studying the etymology of words that are in the same basket as mm-hmm. empathy, things like sympathy, mm-hmm. pity, compassion, I discovered that there's a bit of a continuum, and power, it lives on that continuum. So on the pity side, so pity is on one side and empathy is on the other side. Mm-hmm. We don't want to pity other people, because when you pity someone, there is power embedded in mm-hmm. that relationship. It's intrinsic to when mm-hmm. you pity somebody, you look down on them, you poor person. Mm-hmm. The opposite is true, in my opinion, when you empathize. When you are empathizing with someone, that power asymmetry goes away and it's human to human.
Exactly. It's not about power. Uh-huh. And then we have this situation of we are independent but interdependent, right?
Yes. Well. Yes. We don't want 1984 where we're all the same.
Yeah.
Right? Treated by the overlords.
Yeah.
To have independence and agency,
yeah.
But we are part of a mesh.
And now I'm thinking about this picture about a healthy relationship, right? Relationships become difficult when the I and you becomes only a we, you know. And when in a good functional relationship, you need two pillars, an I and you, and together you carry the roof, right?
Yeah, or the Venn diagram. Yes.
Yeah. That's cool today, right? Very deep, intensive, just in around 45 minutes.
Anybody listening want to put, are there places to put comments in the chat somewhere on your podcast or not?
Usually I don't get comments, but they could write comments. You mean that, right?
Yeah, like I'd love to hear what people are thinking as they're listening to us talk.
Yeah. So how does it feel right now for you up to here, our empathy session, let's say?
Great. I'd love to share one final story and maybe okay. listeners with an idea to think about.
Yeah.
So... And I tell this story quite a bit because I think it's a powerful story where we can really relate to the characters in the story on both sides of the equation, because there's two people in this story. There's me and someone else. So I was in a big office tower in downtown Montreal where there was an express mail service. And this was 15 years ago before we all had phones to distract us when we're in a long lineup. So I was waiting for about 30 minutes to get to the counter because it was the holiday season and everybody was sending packages. And when I got to the counter, the woman who greeted me was very, very rude. Mm-hmm. Not just like a little bit bad day, but just aggressive rude, like, whoa. My initial reaction to her was to call her out on it and to say, what are you talking to me like this? Mm-hmm. But because at the time I was learning about the neuroscience of empathy and the fact that we could become more empathic by practicing empathic behavior, in a flash seconds, I made the decision to not make it about me and my experience with her, but to actually make it about her. And I looked at her and I said, "Are you okay?" And there was a little pause where she was trying to figure out if she was going to share, if I was being sincere or maybe sarcastic or passive aggressive. And she looked at me and she just burst into tears. And she said, "I've been working double shifts for 2 weeks straight. My son is at home with a fever. I'm getting sick. It's 3 p.m. I haven't had a lunch break. I'm just exhausted." And 10 seconds earlier, I really didn't like this gal. And then after she told that to me, we were holding hands across the counter, both of us with tears coming rolling down our cheeks. And I've been her and I was me. You know, we've been on both sides of the equation. And after she said a few things, I remember I got her a mint tea in the food court, and he came back and she sent my package off and everything was lovely. I don't know her name, but I will never forget that experience because it's a constant reminder that we could choose in any moment, at any moment, to lean into empathy. And not only is that an opening for the other person, but it actually is really an opening for you too.
Yeah.
Because the science around how my body felt in the moment of our connection, that empathic embrace, I call it, is that the pleasure and reward centers of my brain would have been lit up, just like when you eat chocolate cake or after an orgasm. It's the serotonin and the oxytocin flowing through bodies. So my breathing would have been deeper. My immune system would be functioning better. Like being connected to someone is good for us.
Yeah.
So I like sharing that story. And thank you for asking if anything was alive for me, because, you know, it's tough to make our way in the world when we're rushing against traffic and trying to get to places on time and stuff. And there's so many demands on our time that we have, you know, we have little reserve for empathy. But making the decision to actually embody more empathy in your life has a reciprocal payoff effect.
Yeah.
And so I guess I just want to leave people thinking about that.
And even being empathic to other persons creates a gift for you, because by asking this woman, she decided to be vulnerable and show up with vulnerability. And the gift was to give you this huge experience of being empathic.
100%.
You never forget, right?
Never forget.
And this is what is the podcast Empathizer or Empathieschenker is about: to be empathic, to understand what's alive in me and in the person in front of me.
Yeah. I felt very heard. I felt you were very present. So thank you for that gift on a Friday afternoon as we're taping this.
Yeah. Thank you too, to show up what's alive in you, what's moving you, what's important for you, and sharing all this wonderful, connected, empathic story. Thank you very much, Anita.
My pleasure.
That was episode 83, Tired from the Doom and Gloom. If you like the podcast, please follow and rate it and share it with your friends on social media. And if you want to be heard with something or give me a feedback, then write to me at podcast@empathieschenker.de. In this sense, see you in 2 weeks.